Welcome to Mish Music Talk with Michelle Weir, in powerful conversations with singers, players, vocal groups, and industry professionals from around the world. This podcast isn't just about the music, it's about life and who the artist really is on the inside.
Hello again, and welcome back to the Mish Music Talk podcast, episode number 15, with, oh my gosh, Kirby Shaw. Wow, Kirby is really so important and influential in our choral educational realm by virtue of many, many hundreds of arrangements that he has written and published dating back to the 1970s, 40 years, long time. First of all, thank you, Kirby, for all that you have contributed, because you gave a lot to our culture and propelled the music forward in lots and lots of ways, and many, many people have been impacted. It used to be that every group in the country that was singing any kind of vocal jazz or choral pop was singing some Kirby Shaw arrangements. I remember first meeting him when I was about 16 years old. I was a young puppy back then, and I knew nothing of really anything about choral music, and especially not about vocal jazz, until I met Phil Mattson in college. And then I began to learn about this art form. And then, of course, I saw Kirby's face on half of the arrangements we were singing, because everyone had him in their repertoire. It was really fun talking with Kirby about the current state of vocal ensemble education, the publishing world, and how it's changed over the years, and how a new arranger could break into working with the bigger, more established publishers like Hellenid or Alfred Publishing, which in reality is, you know, next to impossible. Sorry, but probably true. Though, if you were interested in doing that, you'd probably want to hear Kirby's tips. And also to talk about people that are doing their own online publishing biz, which is pretty common right now. I've done it now for 10 years myself. And it was fun to talk with Kirby, get inside his brain about how he approaches arranging, what his process is, and so on. And as we do on this podcast, we're going to start by playing part of a track from Kirby's vocal group called Just for Kicks. This features Randy Crenshaw, Kirk Marcy, and Vijay Singh. And this track also features a very notable guest, the great Don Shelton of the High Lows and Singers Unlimited fame. The scat solo you're going to hear, though, is from Kirby. So hope you enjoy the podcast.
Dolphin Street supplied the setting.
Green Dolphin Street.
Setting for nights beyond forgetting.
And through these moments apart, memories live in my heart.
When I recall the love I found on, I could kiss the ground on Green Dolphin Street.
Kirby Shaw,
yes.
Welcome to you. It's so nice to have you here.
It's really nice to be here.
And I remember when I was 16 years old, so long ago, and I was singing with the Foothill Fanfares at Foothill College in California, and Phil Madsen was directing. And at that time, every other chart, we're talking 50% of the charts at least, had a big picture of the face of Kirby Shaw on it.
Was it the very first ones had a cartoon picture of me, which was pretty hilarious. Were you unfortunate enough to witness those at all?
I think I was fortunate enough to see probably all of them, because after all those years of adjudicating, of course, I just got to see pretty much every chart you ever wrote. Well,
that's true. Yeah, you and I go back a ways, don't we?
Yeah. So you are really a founding member of the educational vocal jazz community from the get-go.
And I think that's fair to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like to thank you. I'd like to offer you a whatever this is. Is it official? I don't know. An official thank you from the Mish Music Talk podcast for all that you've contributed over these many years to vocal jazz education. It's been just really so substantial.
I really appreciate hearing that from you, Michelle, because you're a first-rate musician. You're a fine writer of music yourself, and who has taught more people how to sing vocal jazz than you. I don't know anyone else that's exceeded what you've done all over the place, all around the world. I mean, I'm honored to be here and to be blabbing with you.
Well, thank you. And yeah. if by that you're trying to say that I'm really old, you know, it's completely true. And yes, I have also spent some years, but I was a youngster when I started, and you had already gotten a leg up on me, and it's just really amazing all that you've contributed.
Oh, thank you, Michelle. Those posters, they seem like posters, because first it was a cartoon on the cover, and it was like a big band chart size format, which music dealers had no idea, they didn't know how to put it in their stores. So it was Hal Leonard Publishing Company was kind of trying to feel their way along too, but they wanted to do something a little different. So they sent a man named John Trepp to the Reno Jazz Festival, and I just happened to be there with my jazz choir from little old College of the Siskiyous, and with an enrollment of about 900 students, and at right place, right time, he was sent there to find something new, and there we were, and he talked to me afterwards, and here I am. That's as quick as I can make that story as far as publishing, becoming a published writer is concerned. So there's, a lot of serendipity going on for that to happen.
So John Trepp was really the conduit for you initially?
He got me started. Actually, I had a benediction and sevenfold amen published in 1969. I need an audience so they can go, ooh, and maybe we can add that sound
sure.
later. And then the Charles Hanson Publishing Company published five pieces of mine in a variety of styles. And I still remember Charles Hanson actually calling me on the phone, and an interesting Jewish guy, and he's going, Kirby, we want to publish some of your music. We can pay you 2.5%. And I thought, wow, I wasn't an authority on what should we get paid as writers and arrangers and composers. But I thought, let me get back to you on that. Because, the standard rate is 10% if you write the song, and 5% if it's somebody else's song. So at least we managed to get a decent royalty for that. But that was five pieces. And then along came John Trepp at the Reno Jazz Festival, and things started to get a little more, I had a larger output over time, and it's been a wonderful ride. I'm so grateful to basically follow the muse that was given to me from some higher power somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's good to remain humble, and I'm grateful every day.
Yeah, and is this the life that you ever foresaw that you would be leading? Is it a life that you wanted to lead? I wonder if you planned for it, if you thought, well, I'm going to be a prolific arranger and a working teacher and clinician in Northern California and all over the world, or if you just stumbled on it and you sort of went with the flow?
I know I was singing, my mother says I was singing recognizable melodies before I could walk. Of course, the joke is I didn't walk till I was 18, but never mind, bada boom, psh. But I sang from as early in my youth as I can remember, before I can remember even. And also I played trumpet, played jazz, heard Louis Armstrong in the eighth grade and went out and bought every LP he made and realized that I could make up melodies just by ear on the trumpet. And it was like, you know, one of those moments in time that changed my life. Band and choir through high school, music major at San Jose State, when tuition was $38. I'm going to say this slow, $38 a semester. Wow. And the other $12 I got from my $50 Paul Masson scholarship paid for my books. How about that? So going through high school, I was a swim instructor. And my dad taught me to question everything. My mother said we was a cheerleader, and she was a art teacher and high school counselor. And her general belief for every human being in the planet was, you know, we can do this if we work together. So I think that was a pretty good combination. So as I was teaching swimming, little kids how to swim and not be afraid of the water, I realized that I had some skill sets that allowed me to be able to teach these kids to swim and have a good time doing it. And I got great delight seeing these kids learn.
So is that where you first resonated with the idea of being a pedagogue?
Yes. Oh, and if that doesn't work, I was even thinking of being a teacher, but never mind. Oh, where's that drummer? We need him. Okay. So that's true. I was a jazz trumpet player through San Jose State, and I thought about being either a jazz trumpet player or a music educator. And at that time, early 60s, a couple of my trumpet playing gig buddies got killed just driving home after a gig. And I was fortunate enough to be in the Santa Clara swim team. And it kind of gave me a basic format for trying to stay in shape for my entire life for as long as possible. And so the idea of smoke-filled clubs, not such a problem now, but smoke-filled clubs and then driving home really late on a Saturday night, you know, drunk people out there, and then losing a couple of my friends, it was a fork in the road, and I took the one that went towards music education. And I really, really don't regret doing that at all.
Yeah, I remember at festivals when you used to bring your trumpet.
I still got it on the stand at home, but I don't have much reason to play.
Mm-hmm. So you really have a super unique a perspective that not very many other people do because of your long tenure in this business of vocal jazz education. I would love to hear your thoughts on where it was back then, which was what, the 70s-ish?
Late 60s even, yeah.
Okay, and what it went through for you over those years and what your thoughts are about it now.
Well, I know when I first started teaching school, I taught band and choir starting in the Mount Shasta Public Schools, fifth grade through grade 12. And I remember having a choir of 40 people, SATB, 40 young people. And all I wanted to do was be able to sing a madrigal pretty well at a festival. And I thought, I'll just be so happy if I can do that. But just a few years after that, I was writing up the chairlift with Roger Emerson, who's another writer that I know you know, and he's a student of mine.
Yep.
At the college. We're writing up the chairlift at the Mount Shasta Ski Bowl, and over this big horn, they had recorded music that they were playing, and I hear, that was the first time I'd heard Spinning Wheel. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Chicago Transit Authority, before they shortened their name to Chicago, was around about that time. And I thought, you know, I was thinking, oh, man, how cool would it be to have horns with a small group of singers? So I wasn't necessarily, and by this time I was teaching at College of the Siskiyous after going back and getting a master's degree. And I wasn't the choral guy at the college, but I thought, okay, what, maybe I can start a little hybrid group. And so I did, with 8 singers and 5 horns, and I just jumped in because there was no music like that at all in the early 70s that I could find. I mean, if you could find a pop arrangement by Ed Lojeski, that was like a victory, like, oh, wow, this has kind of a cool piano part.
Now, there were Anita Kerr arranged some things.
Yes, yeah, she did. Then. What, House Is Not a Home is probably your most famous one. Mm-hmm. But again, not super jazzy. It was just, you know, we were kind of pecking around the edges of a new movement back then. So I just jumped in. I never thought I would be a composer or, you know, arranger of anything. But I've always enjoyed words and how they work. And how you combine them in, you know, creative ways. And I've always admired other musicians, and I always enjoyed listening to singers. And I remember hearing, you know, I go back far enough to hear, to remember, Doris Day singing, "Hey, Sarah, Sarah," right? And then I'm hearing, again, this is in the San Francisco Bay Area. Then I hear from KSAN out of Oakland, "Well, I went to the store when they opened." That's White Port and Lemon Juice. I didn't realize there was a tune about a wino, but I thought, oh man, that groove, you know, shuffle groove. I had not heard that many shuffle grooves. I mean, I remember swing music. I remember hearing In the Mood, mm-hmm. way after it was popular, but it was still around.
And, so you were inspired by all of those, you know, really early influences, and obviously you took that and, you know, brought it into your world of being a newbie arranger.
Yeah, and why do people sound the way they do? Why do they bend those notes? So I got really interested in examining how people change individual notes and to express their feelings. And I found over the years that not a lot of people pay a lot of attention to that, but I thought it was really interesting. And so that was an important factor in my writing of popular music in general and jazz in particular. It's like, let's get some marks in there and then explain them so people can get some understanding and sound more authentic, like mm-hmm. the best practitioners that are out there.
Mm-hmm. So how have things changed? We went through quite a few decades now mm-hmm. of stuff. How have things changed in the schools? How have things changed at the festivals? How have things changed with the literature?
You might have to remind me of the last two, but in terms of support, it's really discouraging to see. I remember Prop 13, I believe it was, in California, where they put a lid on property tax, and suddenly state support for schools started to drop. And that same thing happened in Oregon with a Proposition 5, I believe, sometime later. So vibrant programs, you know, again, it's very subjective, but a whole lot of programs just started to just kind of go away. You know, my daughter's a jazz choir director, and so is my son-in-law, but she was directing a choir as recently as a year ago, getting up at 5 in the morning for the 7 o'clock before school rehearsal. So you get that kind of thing going on. So it's not in the curriculum anymore.
Right.
So yeah, how creative can you be to find a way to have music in the school survive? I think that's a real shame.
Yep. Anything you want to comment on regarding contemporary music that is being published and the recent influx of so many people like myself that have their own publishing companies online, and the Jeremy Fox and, of course, Carrie Marsh and even Rosanna Eckert. Mm-hmm. How has that changed things for the publication world?
Well, I believe it's, you know, the royalties that people, I know, speaking personally, when I first started, I think Hal Leonard was publishing like 40 pieces a year. Now it's hundreds and hundreds each year. So there's just been a huge proliferation from the major music publishers, and then the whole tech boom has resulted in making individual composers or giving them the opportunity to have their own online publishing, which I think is great. So it's I think just about everybody who was there at the beginning, who was, you know, maybe one of the few games in town, were making really good incomes, and now maybe it's not quite so good, but it's still, I have no complaints. I think my royalties have dropped maybe a third from what it used to be some years ago, for a variety of reasons, including people that are selling music illegally online or giving it away for free and it's published. Somebody in England ordered a piece of mine and said, I want to do the right thing. I know this piece you wrote is out of print, but I'd like to order it. But I just want you to know that there are 4 online places I can get your arrangement right now for free.
Yeah, right.
And I thought, that's really discouraging.
Oh, I know. I remember the first 20 times I saw the same thing, and I saw my books being sold at some ridiculous discount. So if it, you know, no one would ever buy it at the real price it's supposed to be, and so on, and how disheartening that was. And I started to hear my friends on Spotify, and I, at the time, I don't think they knew they were on there and being given away basically for free. And
where'd the morality go? Can we blame the drugs in the 60s for that? I'm not sure, but
I don't think so.
Yeah, this business of music should be for free. Oh, really? Well, give me that car then that your father owns on the car lot down there from the dealership.
Yeah. Hey, just one little plug for the Chuck Shearer Publishing Company, Shearer Music Publishing, that they recently started offering both a la carte in whatever key you want songs, and they're not arrangements, but they're solo singer lead sheets, which, I mean, in reality, I encourage all singers to learn how to write their own lead sheets, but they, 60% of them don't want to do that. So, but anyway, it's just a nice new thing that there's availability for good quality jazz-friendly charts.
That's nice to know.
Online.
Yeah, you and I have been whining a little bit here about the current state of things. But on the other hand, anything is available now. That's the good news. And it's just, you know, what are you interested in?
And it's given an opportunity to so many arrangers now.
Absolutely. I just want them to do the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also nice that the big publishing houses, Hal Leonard and Alfred and Shawnee, which is associated with them and so on, are allowing for the opportunity to provide print licenses and have a contractual agreement that allows for people to arrange songs that they control.
Yeah,
which didn't used to be the case.
And that's pretty recent. So any of you listening to this podcast, if you want to write an arrangement and sell it, or you do whatever you want with it, you can contact Hal Leonard online, or Alfred, or Shawnee, and get permission pretty easily. And that is really amazing.
Yes, absolutely. And speaking of arranging, according to your bio materials, 3,000
I deny
published.
Everything. Yeah, including voicings, it would be 3,000. It's more like, you know, 1,200 pieces in a variety of voicings.
Oh, only 1,200. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Really.
Not very impressive.
Sloth-like, yeah.
Yeah, and 20 million copies sold.
Something,
not 19
something
million,
like that. Yeah.
Not 15 million.
Yeah, and not a single
million.
One more. No, I'm kidding.
That's amazing.
Amazed. Yeah.
Okay, so here's what we want to know, because you and I are educators at heart. We want to share with people, how do you do that? What's the Kirby Shaw process, especially for writing so many volumes of works? This is something I always am curious about with Carrie Marsh also, and I will ask him someday. But how do you, you know, like, what's the whole process? If you can give us bullet point step by step, somebody asks you to do a commission. How do you decide the song? How do you decide what level of difficulty? Blah, blah, blah.
Well, I started doing, well, level of difficulty would just be who is it that's being directed here? What's the level of the group? For me, it's been pretty much mixed voices and, you know, high school or above level. Some harder, some real barn burners for festivals, you know, where you let it all hang out, and but then there are or even some things that have a little bit of jazz in them that are sacred, where it's, you know, the average church choir is like 11 people and there's 8 women and 3 men. So a 3-part with a little bit of jazz quality, that can work, you know. I basically go with songs that knock me out, that I just, either the lyric is wonderful or the melody is fabulous or both, or the harmonies are nice. But more than anything, I think it might just be the groove. I mean, is there another country in the world? I mean, this is the groove capital of the world. And I remember the first time I heard Some Kind of Wonderful, Grand Funk Railroad. I was working on my doctorate at the University of Washington, and I hear this, I don't need, I just thought, this is just, I pulled my car off to the side of the road to listen to it. You know, it was that interesting.
Yeah. So you choose the song.
Generally, sometimes there'll be a suggestion from Hal Leonard, but I've kind of stayed independent, and I kind of like it that way. I'm not an exclusive writer for anyone. Hal Leonard has several exclusive writers, you know, like Mac Huff and Mark Breimer and Roger Emerson. Those are the main three. And I've chosen not to do that because I kind of like being independent.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay, and then you decide on the level of difficulty, which in your case is largely appealing to the high school.
Right. Although level. I've written I just did an arrangement of Itsy Bitsy Spider for 2-part in a swing version. Itsy Bitsy Spider, da, 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 water spout. Mm. You know, so I like the idea of teaching young people how to swing. I've written three tune medleys called Junior Jazz 1, 2, and 3, and just explaining the elements of jazz. So I've tried to write for every level. Some songs fit great. I try and do something. I love a cappella, so I've done a lot of those. I like writing spirituals. I like mm-hmm. I like rockers that have good rhythm. So I'm pretty eclectic in my tastes.
Have you written much traditional choral?
What do you mean by traditional?
Classical-ish.
A few, but more likely I wrote a piece called We're the Choir, which is very Mozartian-like, where each section describes who they are. You know, basses, the mighty basses, providing a foundation is what we do best. Helpless, yes, they'd be helpless, gesturing to the rest of the choir. Without the basses. And the sopranos are divas, and the tenors operas where we like to be. And the altos only sing 4 or 5 notes. And then one of the altos gets upset and has a tantrum in the middle of their little piece of the 4-part texture that comes together all together at the end and gets carried off the stage, you know, wailing over somebody's back. So crazy things like that I enjoy writing as well. So definitely not jazz. And that's about as close to classical as I've come. I've done a Renaissance, a cappella Renaissance medley, done a Baroque medley of Christmas pieces, but generally not much classical.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Yeah, I really haven't done much classical either, except some works that could straddle both worlds mm-hmm. pretty well, mm-hmm. you know. I did write a nice, Kenny Burrell is my boss at UCLA.
Well, he's been there a while, hasn't he?
Yes, we're doing his... We're preparing already for his 85th birthday,
which will be a big deal
at Royce Hall, a big Royce Hall concert. And we're going to do a suite of music that he wrote for the Boys Choir of Harlem.
Oh, nice.
And they recorded many years ago, and we're going to recreate that. And I'm conducting. And, you know, last time for his 80th birthday, some of his friends dropped by, like Stevie Wonder.
Oh, geez.
B.B. King and D.D. Bridgewater.
Yeah, he's got serious people skills besides the musical skills. He really does. You could drop him in the Arctic and he'd make friends with the penguins, I swear.
Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to your arranging process. So you're ready to write your arrangement, and what do? Take a drive in the country? Do you sit at the piano and toil around?
Well, I'm on.
Do you listen to it in your head first?
I listen to it, and then I usually get a lead sheet and then see how I can change the harmony if it feels like it ought to be changed to me. Try and be creative. I love writing horn parts, and when you're selling a company, you know, rehearsal performance CDs, I find it's helpful. But mainly it's a musical reason to write horn parts to pieces that are famous, that have good grooves and, you know, meaningful in some way. And that can add, you know, that can make it unique, even if my vocal arranging is not, you know, I haven't messed with the tune a lot, kept it fairly straight, maybe changed the harmony. And that's frequent that I'll change the rhythm. Well, if it's a jazz chart, for sure the rhythm's going to be changed. And a variety of things go into it. You know, I've got a keyboard there. I'm using Finale.
So are you sitting at your keyboard?
Yeah, sitting
most
at the keyboard. Almost exclusively.
And then going direct to Finale. I mean, very quickly, early on,
do you
start sketching on Finale or
I just start writing the melody and thinking, you know, try different harmonic substitutes. I'm not a good enough piano player to just play in everything so it's on there correctly the first time. But, you know, playing a middle C and hitting a four for a quarter note or three, whatever the number is, it's automatic. I don't even think of what the number is anymore. That can go pretty quickly. So in a couple of days, I can usually do an arrangement of something to my satisfaction.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's
and then you add other voicings as well. Frequently, it's SATB, SAB, and SSA.
Mm-hmm.
But other
that's
times,
that's usually pretty easy though. Once you've got the first done,
yes, it is
right.
Mm-hmm.
And then, do you think? I mean, your arrangements sell very well and have been sung so much because they work, right? They work very, very well.
That's the idea. One of my wishes would be when I got out of college starting to teach, I just thought, man, we're all gonna learn. We're all teachers. It's just music teachers. We're all just kind of, there's so much available now. We're just all gonna be great. And it dawned on me later that, you know, a lot of people are average like everywhere else in the world. What was I thinking, you know? So as a music educator, I've tried to empower other music educators with my writing so that it's clear what I'm looking for. And then the advent of rehearsal performance cassettes and CDs. I remember at Hal Leonard, the person who was in charge of thinking about that possibility of having those cassettes available, I remember him saying, oh, those will never sell. Those aren't going to be worth anything. And I'm thinking, if you get a good recording, what a huge educational boost that will be for teachers that have never sung jazz or even sung popular music. I mean, back in high school, there was no popular music to sing. I remember that. I remember one tune in 12/8, and then there's those, quote, Negro spirituals, right? And that's as rhythmic as things got, pretty much, back in the late 50s. So it's, you know, wow, what a sea change. So empowering, you know, you and I are in the people empowerment business, really, and music is the key. That's what, that's kind of how I look at what I'm doing. So I want to empower people every way I can. So that's why there are inflection marks in my music to help people smear notes and fall off and doit and shake and whatever, so they will sound more like the original recordings if those recordings are worth imitating, you know? Because some artists, you don't want to sound like they're sounding, otherwise you might get fired for ruining your singers' voices in your school program.
How can a student... Someone that's in, let's say they're in a college, University of North Texas. They're working with Jennifer Barnes there and Rosanna Eckert and
so
on. We've
got some great people out there now.
They do. It's really a great situation there, I think. But let's say you're a student and you're an arranger and you want to break into the publishing world. How would one go about that?
Well, the easiest thing these days would be to just start your own publishing online. But what I tell people that want to go to the publishers that are more well known, like Hal Leonard or Alfred, what I tell them is, have a flawless looking arrangement, one that looks really, really good. Find somebody that knows more than you do about the calligraphy aspect of that and make sure it looks really good. Have it open to the page. Go to a festival where they're in the industrial booths, the exhibits, there will be, a booth for Hal Leonard or any of these other publishers, Santa Barbara. I mean, it's a fairly long list. Have the headphones set beforehand to the size of the head of the person you want to listen to this recording and make sure it's a really good recording. Catch them just about the time, sometime when no one else is bothering them or talking with them, and just say, could you give this a listen for me? I just want you to hear this.
Don't you have to say something first, like, hi, my name is John, and gosh, I've admired your work so many years.
Yes, that's true.
And then you just have them take a listen. Because what happens if somebody just sends in a submission?
Not going to happen.
Not going to get anywhere.
Not going to happen. It's been that way for a long, long time. I'd say
because
at least 30 years.
The desks of Emily Crocker, although I'm not even sure she's the main person.
She's kind of the decider at Hal Leonard. That's true.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But, I'm sure her best desk is quite full. And
beyond full.
Yeah, I mean, she can't possibly listen to an unrecommended submitter.
That's exactly right.
Now, if Kirby Shaw said, hey, this kid's really talented and he'd really be good in this particular market.
The chances go up. Yeah. Another good way is if you can get a group to be chosen to sing at a convention and they happen to be singing your chart, that is a really good way to get in the door.
Mm-hmm. So if they listen, you've resized the headphones to accommodate whoever is going to be listening. And so that's working well. And then they actually are willing to take a moment to listen. If they like it, meaning it sounds catchy and it sounds singable and it sounds good for one of their series or something like that, then...
Maybe. Yeah, every year I see a few new names. Well, I remember when you first broke into Hal Leonard, Michelle.
I was 20. I was 22, I believe.
Yeah.
And that was that SSAA arrangement of Rockabye Baby.
Rockabye Baby. I know every part of
years
that
ago,
piece.
And it's still in print.
That's a great chart. I would put that in your top four or five charts, Michelle. I'm just saying. I mean it. I've sung that all over the place.
There's a lot of other charts. But, I mean, I was thrilled as a 22-year-old to get that published.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So here's I'll just bug you with a direct question.
Okay.
Has the publishing business been very lucrative for you?
I would say so, compared to teaching at a school. When I left College of the Siskiyous in 1980, I was making $28,500 and didn't know how to spend all the money. Because things were so much less expensive back then. It has been lucrative, far beyond, if you've been teaching 10 years at a university, now maybe 15, and I'm guessing here, but a somewhat educated guess, you could be making $70,000 after 10 years of teaching with a couple of degrees, and I've been able to surpass that. I've never done this really for the money. I've done it because I've loved it, and I just love what happens when people come together to sing. This world has a lot of whacked outness going on now, and all the time there's some bad things going on the planet, and I like to think that what you and I do makes a difference. And so anywhere people are gathered to sing is a place I like to be. You sign on, on the metaphor for it. You're signing on for a common goal. And you work hard to achieve it. You check your ego at the door, hopefully, with a few exceptions. And you make this happen, and you feel good about it because you all succeeded. And it prepares you to do more and to be and to get your face on in a concert, right? And be a little more open facially and emotionally, just as you sing. And maybe that results in, if you're a parent and you got a little child coming up through school and you decide to go to a board meeting, maybe your complaint to the board might have more power because you sang in a choir and learned those skills about communication, you know, in a different way.
Yeah. And I really appreciate John Jacobson's organization, mm-hmm. the
American
benefit
Sings.
Organization.
Yeah, yeah, I've
right.
been involved with that for a long time.
Yes,
all good.
I know you have.
No bad. All good.
Yeah, I love
yeah, he's
John
great.
For that.
He's
I
great.
Appreciate him. Yeah. So, you know, regarding the lucrative part of it, isn't it the case that you're going to make money in publishing these arrangements only if there's a very high volume sold, right?
Correct.
Because we're earning, I forgot what it is, 7.5% if it's a non-public domain tune, and maybe it's 10% if it's a public domain tune, and they only sell for $2.25. So you got to sell lots
right.
and lots and lots
right.
to really see any money.
Yeah, I remember I did an arrangement of And So It Goes, Billy Joel. Mm-hmm. And I remember it sold 50,000 copies in the first 6 months. And that was 25 years ago.
Wow.
Or something like close to that. And I remember thinking, wow, this is amazing. But that doesn't happen much anymore for anybody because of the proliferation
yeah.
we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't make as much money as some other writers. My guess is that Roger Emerson probably makes more money than anybody, and he's he just lives an hour away, and we talk at least once or twice a month. But his goal is to write music at a level where anybody can sing it. So he doesn't take a lot of he doesn't expand and get crazy at all. He keeps it right down the middle, and that's not a criticism, but that's been his philosophy.
But he writes also for high school,
right,
probably
and junior high a lot.
And all the different
right.
voicings and
right.
junior high, right. And maybe some elementary.
Mm-hmm.
Does
yeah,
he write
the junior
elementary?
High has been his kind of his specialty. And I think he's done better. I don't know how other people have done, but I know some people can make more than $100,000. I did that for a while before things started, before the proliferation of
all the independence
and just number of publications. You know, Rogers noticed a change too.
Why has the, I'm sorry, I wanted to follow up on this when you
yeah,
first
yeah.
mentioned it earlier. Why are the publishers issuing so many more volumes
I don't
of
know.
Works?
I really don't know. It's baffling. Every arranger I know wonders why.
I mean, it must be because there's a market for it.
Theoretically,
right?
I know one reason is that take Hal Leonard, for example. They work out agreements with various people, copyright owners, like Disney. I remember 30 years ago, they were paying Walt Disney $1 million a year for exclusive rights to their music, which means nobody else can publish choral arrangements or band arrangements of their music except Hal Leonard. Well, that means you better get a whole bunch of stuff out the door, correct? So that, and there, so they have lots, and there's continual competition going on between the, particularly Alfred and Hal Leonard. A lot of times a piece that the arrangers write for Hal Leonard will last a few years, and then Alfred will outbid them for the following year, and so your arrangement disappears. And sometimes it goes over to the other company and you don't get paid for it, which is, that's not so good. You know, we can thank Irving Berlin for getting royalties at all. By the way, he's the guy that started ASCAP. Yeah. Yeah. He's the guy.
Huh. Hey, I heard, I have been hearing about Happy Birthday and the ongoing question of whether that is public domain.
I think
or not.
Some big court just ruled that it is public domain. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I just, reading that, I just arranged it four different ways and crazy ways, and including a vocal jazz way, and submitted it to Alfred, and we'll see if something happens with that. But it's, that's an interesting sidelight, isn't it? wondered about that for a long time. I remember doing a very jazzy arrangement of Ain't That Good News, and William Dawson, the composer, I did it to honor him and his legacy of writing fabulous spirituals. And his lawyers came after us. And we had to take it off the market after spending $1,500 in legal fees because I spelled it A-I-N apostrophe A, like they owned that. I mean, they were so, what's the term? Strict. And now, you know, since William Dawson has passed on, there's probably 15 arrangements of that piece out there. So just a little gripe about the past. I thought, oh, really? This spiritual has been around a long time before William Dawson was around. So, you know, lawyers can create havoc real easily.
Well, I'm also, I would like to hear how things are going with your vocal group, Just for Kicks, who has several of my actually very good friends in the group, Vijay Singh, who teaches at my alma mater.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, I got my undergrad degree there. Kelly Kunz was there. We were working together at the time. We were buds and stuff. And Dave Bardoon was there getting his master's. And for one of the years, he conducted the jazz choir. So
cool.
I was tooted. Tutelage from
Dave.
Hey,
you mentioned Kelly Kunz. I got to say that, what was it, Clash of the Choirs and his group, Groove for Thought? And I saw them on there, and I thought, you know, I'm thinking Star Search, and you know, you sing a third space treble clef C for four beats without breathing,
and then you get a
standing ovation, and people go wild. It's like, wow, have we inflated or lowered the bar on what people appreciate? It's kind of scary, actually. But I remember Kelly's group, Groove for Thought, and I thought, this group is so much hipper. And I thought, this group is too hip for the room. There's no way they're going to win because they're too good and they don't have enough flash and trash going on. And boy, was I prophetic on that one. So I have a real problem with competition, by the way. And that's one of the reasons. You know, what are they judging? Because that group was so good. They should have, for me, they would have been the winner, hands down.
Well, I don't know everything they're up to now, but I have the feeling, I think good things are happening for them. I know that there's a business deal where some of their arrangements are now issued through Carrie Marsh's
company. That's good to hear. And hey, and a cappella singing is, you can whine if you want about some of the arrangements and where lyrics and melody and harmony have gone in pop music for the last, I'd say, 20 years or so. But the fact that so many people think a cappella is cool now is a real blessing for music in general, I think.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? With those Pitch Perfect movies and the sing-off and Glee. I mean, it's quite trendy.
Super trendy,
right now.
Yeah. I guess I would have a wish that because you can add layer upon layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. Is that enough layers?
One more, please.
One more layers. when you're working, you know, with finale and things, you can just keep adding things. I had a bunch of wishes, but one of the wishes was, do you have to add that extra part just because you can? Because I can't hear the melody anymore. You know, that's where I start to go, wait a minute, what happened to the melody? And if the harmony, and there's so many really, really creative people out there, but I sense, it's a little like tenor saxophone players following John Coltrane. It's like, how do we move it forward from there? How do we play more notes? And I always want to say, no, wait a minute, you don't have to play more notes, just make the notes you play count more. So same thing with a cappella writings. Like don't bury the melody in endless textures or, you know.
Yeah. Hey, how is your
Just for Kicks? Well, we don't do a lot of gigging, but when we get together, it's a lot of fun. You know, our first rehearsal 20 plus years ago, we had a 10-hour rehearsal and we laughed for 9 hours. And that still happens. We like to say we have more concerts than rehearsals, because two guys live in Washington, Randy Crenshaw, the singing voice of Homer Simpson, who I met recording for Hal Leonard down here in L.A. He lives here. Well, he lives in Oxnard. And we love to say the town name for him when we introduce him in a concert. And Randy hails from the town of Oxnard.
Why is that?
Well, I think it has to do with some private parts of the bovine species.
Oh,
yes.
And I didn't
so
get
we
that.
We have to say that loudly and with terrible tone quality just to make people think about it.
You people are very silly on and off stage, man.
So the other two guys are up in Washington, as you were saying, and we do have a lot of fun, and you know, we can all improvise. We're all arrangers. We're all conductors. We all like humor. So most of our charts have no written bass lines, just chord symbols. I remember the bass singer in the real group heard us one time and wanted to see the charts, and so we showed him the charts and he goes, you have no bass notes written out. So VJ explained to them that we just make them up. We don't do the same chart the same way twice. But we are actually doing a gig in Ellensburg for an outdoor music festival in July. And then we some years back, 5 or 6 years ago, we started a Real Men Sing, which somebody else had going before we did. We had to change the title to Guys Got to Sing. And of course, we have a number two there in the title, so we can look hip. But this is for Puget Sound young men from junior high through high school, with some college mentor guys dropping in and
nice.
Doing a little demo and demonstrating and singing along with us.
Hey, why don't you start a publishing series called that and start encouraging more men?
Well, we're up to, we're up to close to 300 young men. We started with 50 and now it's huge.
That's awesome. Because just for our listeners, probably most people listening this far to this know this, but you know, there's commonly a shortage of men choral groups and jazz groups, and that's historically
that's the reason we started this.
The case.
Because Kirk Marcy, one of our members, his wife was saying, and she's a teacher at Cascade High School in Everett. She says, Kirk, why don't you guys just for kicks just start a one day get together for young men around the Puget Sound, and so I can get a few more men in my choir. And we did, and her choir has a whole lot of men in it now. So that's one of the best things we've ever done. And so it grew from very small the first year to hundreds at this point. And I'd love to see that in every major urban center around the country. That would be a fabulous thing to do.
That's really neat. So we would love to know something. We on the Mish Music Talk podcast, we pretty much always like to get into people's personal lives a little bit, because you know, out in the world you're spending so much time just dealing with your music and your business and all that stuff, and we know there's more to you than that. And I happen to know that you have a lovely wife named Marquita.
Mm-hmm.
And you
you said that so beautifully. Much better than some of the elementary school teachers she had. Marguerite, Marquita,
Yes. And
M-A-R-K-I-T-A. Is it really that mysterious? She was thinking in the fourth grade.
I would, even if I had never heard it, I would say Marquita.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Anyway, and then because I'm a tremendous dog lover, I also noticed that you've got a border collie mix named Tux, which is an adorable name.
He's sort of border collie and Newfie, Newfoundland.
Yeah.
Like the back half of him literally looks like he's a Newfie. And then the front half starts to morph towards, a little narrower nose, a little less drooling than a Newfie does, although he does have moments. And a little white color on his chest and his legs, which he sort of likes to herd you just a little bit.
So does my girl, Emma.
And this dog loves to play. He works us in the yard. He'll go behind a tree and he'll work that section of the yard while both of us chase him. And then he runs past us and we try and grab him and make sure we don't quite grab him.
Oh, you dogs know, really. Are the best.
And he'll drop down, you know, his front forepaws just, boom, and his head goes down like, let's do something.
Yes.
He does that more than any dog we've ever owned, and he's terrific. So pretty cool.
Yeah.
And my wife, married 35 years now, she taps, she dances, she's a choreographer. We did show choir camps of America all through the 80s. We've been to Sweden half a dozen times.
You know what I remember about Marquita? It's been a lot of years since I've seen her, but please give her my warm regards.
I sure will.
And
always happy to do that.
But what I remember is, oh gosh, it was at least 20 years ago. We were at some event and you were boasting that what Marquita can do is that a whole choir of 20 or 25 people can come in and everybody will introduce themselves and mention their name. Then at the next rehearsal, she'll go through every single person and go, you know, name their name. She has like that kind of a memory.
Yeah, it's tough for me to stay up with her sometimes. She's very sharp. Hmm. But we really are soulmates. Our sense of aesthetics, you know, I mean, music can be a challenge too, but marriage can be a challenge, of course. And you know, if you can't compromise, it probably doesn't work out. And we've got that figured out pretty well.
Yeah.
But aesthetically, we're like two peas in a pod, and that is brings us both such joy. I mean, you will look or listen to something artistic, and we'll have pretty much the same responses all the time.
Mm.
And it's fascinating,
Kirby,
and wonderful.
What is one thing that you like to do that is completely non-musical?
Well, let's see. I can't go back. I was surfing a lot before the Beach Boys, before crowds took over and testosterone ruled the waves. Was that enough philosophy for that little segment? I love to hike. Love to landscape. But I think hiking, we live on 24 acres in a forest. So we're basically turned, you know, a kind of coniferous forest. And so we've kind of turned our 24 acres into a park. Limb the trees up to 20 feet. I've got built switchback trails going up on the steeper part of our property. Just being outdoors, you know, you can be having a bad day and you go outdoors and start working and you feel better.
I have done my share of hiking, as you know. I didn't know that you like to hike.
Oh, I like to hike a lot.
I might have suggested, since you are here at my abode right now, I might have suggested that we go run up into the hills behind my house. But,
you know, if I didn't have all my clothing figured out for my trip to Australia for 2 weeks starting tomorrow, I would be happy to do that. But when I come down to L.A. to record twice a year, I always try and climb Mount Wilson.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And that's 13 miles and about 5,000 feet elevation gain.
Yeah, good.
And that's that keeps you honest. That hike isn't for sissies.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, living where we live is we live at 5,100 feet, so that's not for sissies either. Mm-hmm. You know, you have four seasons.
Yeah.
We had 3-4 feet of snow at the deepest depth this last winter.
So we are just about ready for the double time round.
Double time round.
The double time round.
Ooh.
Yes, and
like Louis Armstrong.
Okay.
That's what he does all the time.
Playing double time?
You pick up his double time playing. It's all the time in his playing. It's just amazing. It took me a bunch of years to figure that out. But once it dawned on me, it's like, oh, no wonder.
Oh.
Yeah, he does double time.
Thank you for that. I'm going to pay attention next time I hear Louis Armstrong. So the double time round is just some questions that have to do with anything and everything. And as you can imagine, because the double time round sounds like something fast, I will just rattle them off to you. And you've got 5 or 6 seconds to get your favorite answer back to me.
I will try.
It's kind of a secret. It's like a subtle tip. Your Ooh. Favorite answer. That doesn't mean the right answer.
Okay, you know, so I can... Like, okay, well, so if it's not a complete sentence, it doesn't make me a bad person, right?
Well, we'll see. I mean, you may lose points, but...
okay.
But we'll see. Okay, so here we go. Here's question number one. Who is your favorite vocal group pre-Lambert, Hendrix, and Ross?
Oh, boy.
5 seconds. Five seconds.
Would that be Four Freshmen then?
I don't know that they're pre-Lambert Hendricks and Ross. I have no idea.
Lambert Hendricks and Ross would be, what, 50s, mid-50s, 60s? No, Four Freshmen go back to 1948.
Okay, there you go then. All right.
So, okay, I'm safe on that one.
I was hoping you were going to say the Boswell Sisters, my new favorite early group.
Oh, they're pretty cool.
They are very
cool. I did not know them for a long time. But,
all right,
good.
Number two, what is the molecular composition of water?
Wetness.
That is correct. What kind of car are you driving these days? Not
RAV4 2001 gets 27 miles to the gallon. I vowed in high school I would never have a car that got less than 20 miles to the gallon.
You got
that
an outdoorsy car. Okay. And you're a green outdoorsy.
Well, we
got to
have four-wheel drive where we live.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cool. Okay. How much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
Oh, depends on how long his teeth can last.
Well, you're going to have to give me a number.
Four cords.
Right. Okay, fine. Excellent.
Per
Good
hour.
Answer. Who was the tenor saxophone player who was sometimes associated with Billie Holiday?
Oh, Lester Young.
Of course. What is my middle name?
Beautiful.
Well, it should be, of course. My parents didn't think of that.
What
but,
is your middle name, Michelle?
Arlene.
Oh, my goodness.
Kind of
goodness.
Unusual.
Yes,
Arlene.
These days particularly.
Okay, and last but not least, what is your favorite arrangement of yours?
Oh, boy. That's tough. I've done so many different genres.
5 seconds.
I know. I'm
Go.
In trouble. In terms of message, I wrote a song called Tear Them Down. One by one, all the walls that divide us. We won't quit till the work is done.
That was the buzzer. Sorry, no points for that.
And love and peace will unite us.
Okay, good. I'll give you a quarter point. All right, thank you. Very good.
Thank you, Michelle, for doing this. And it's been a pleasure knowing you. I look forward to many more years. Admiring the work you do and the music you create. So keep it happening.
And just a reminder to everyone that is listening, first of all, thank you so much, everybody, for being with us and being interested in joining us on these podcasts. And for everything that Kirby and I have spoken about that could have a link or a note about it, you can find that in the podcast notes on my website, mishmusic.com, mishmusic.com /podcast. And there you can hear the podcast, or you can also hear it on YouTube or in iTunes and probably other places too. Who knows?
Can I say one more thing, Michelle?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to listen to any of the music I've done, go to kirbyshaw.com. We have complete recordings of just about everything.
Thank you for that. I should have actually asked you
and
that.
And click on Moments in Time. There's some really fun things to see from the history there.
So Moments in Time, what is that? Just tell us.
It's just kind of a cavalcade of my experiences, you know, scatting with Bobby McFerrin, writing an arrangement of Bridge Over Troubled Water that for the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Wow.
The week after they had a bad earthquake and lost some people. And I guess it the message fit the occasion, and it was a lot of tears being shed.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that became an iconic arrangement.
It's true. Clay Aiken even sang it on American Idol back in the day. Mm. Yeah.
Hmm. And it will
and
always...
And thank me for it, which was amazing. I didn't even know he was singing it on the for his...
Yeah. And of course, my dear friend, Dr. Stephen Segre, sang it with every group that he ever directed, pretty much.
I should have sent him half the royalties because he went all over the place. And it's sweet, too, because my daughter ended up, when she was there in the 90s, was the lead soprano that sang the solos on that. And so a lot of people are copying my daughter's singing that solo, which is, that's pretty flattering when that happens.
Yeah, that's neat. Well, Kirby, thank you so much. It's been
you
great
are
to
more
have,
than welcome.
It's really great to have this long-time friendship with you, and I appreciate you so much.
Back at you, girl.
All righty. See you next time.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us for today's podcast, and please don't forget to subscribe. Visit www.mishmusic.com/podcast for more info about today's guest and links to products and people that were discussed. See you next time.